Dinah's hands were cold in Laurel's. I'm scared, she repeated. Honey, it'll be like going down a playground slide, Brian said. The man with the English accent is waiting at the bottom to catch you. He's got his hands up just like a catcher in a baseball game. Not, he reflected, that Dinah would know what that looked like. Dinah looked at him as if he were being quite foolish.
None of that. I'm scared of this place. It smells funny.
Laurel, who detected no smell but her own nervous sweat, looked helplessly at Brian. Honey, Brian said, dropping to one knee in front of the little blind girl, we have to get off the plane. You know that, don't you? The lenses of the dark glasses turned toward him.
Why? Why do we have to get off the plane? There's no one here.
Brian and Laurel exchanged a glance. Well, Brian said, we won't really know that until we check, will we?
I know already, Dinah said. There's nothing to smell and nothing to hear, but...
But what, Dinah? Laurel asked. Dinah hesitated. She wanted to make them understand that the way she had to leave the plane was really not what was bothering her. She had gone down slides before, and she trusted Laurel. Laurel would not let go of her hands if it was dangerous. Something was wrong here. Wrong. And that was what she was afraid of. The wrong thing. It wasn't the quiet, and it wasn't the emptiness. It might have to do with those things, but it was more than those things. Something wrong.
But grown-ups did not believe children, especially not blind children, even more especially not blind girl children. She wanted to tell them they couldn't stay here, that it wasn't safe to stay here, that they had to start the plane up and get going again.
But what would they say? Okay, sure, Dinah's right. Everybody back on the plane? No way.
They'll see. They'll see that it's empty, and then we'll get back on the airplane and go someplace else. Someplace where it doesn't feel wrong. There's still time, I think.
Never mind, she told Laurel. Her voice was low and resigned.
Lower me down.
Laurel lowered her carefully onto the slide. A moment later, Dinah was looking up at her. Except she's not really looking, Laurel thought. She can't really look at all, with her bare feet splayed up behind her on the orange slide. Okay, Dinah? Laurel asked.
No, Dinah said. Nothing's okay here.
And before Laurel could release her, Dinah unlocked her hands from Laurel's and released herself. She slid to the bottom and Nick caught her.
Laurel went next, dropping neatly onto the slide and holding her skirt primly as she slid to the bottom. That left Brian, the snoozing drunk at the back of the plane, and that fun-loving, paper-ripping party animal, Mr. Crewneck Jersey.
I'm not going to have any trouble with him, Brian had said, because I don't give a crap what he does. Now he discovered that was not really true. The man was not playing with a full deck. Brian suspected even the little girl knew that, and the little girl was blind. What if they left him behind and the guy decided to go on a rampage? What if, in the course of that rampage, he decided to trash the cockpit? So what? You're not going anyplace. The tanks are almost dry. Still, he didn't like the idea. And not just because the 767 was a multi-million dollar piece of equipment, either. Perhaps what he felt was a vague echo of what he had seen in Dinah's face as she looked up from the slide. Things here seemed wrong, even wronger than they looked. And that was scary, because he didn't know how things could be wronger than that. The plane, however, was right. Even with its fuel tanks all but empty, it was a world he knew and understood.
Your turn, friend, he said as civilly as he could.
You know I'm going to report you for this, don't you? Craig Toomey asked in a queerly gentle voice. You know I plan to sue this entire airline for $30 million and that I plan to name you a primary respondent.
That's your privilege, Mr. Toomey. Craig Toomey.
Mr. Toomey, Brian agreed. He hesitated. Mr. Toomey, are you aware of what has happened to us?
Craig looked out the open doorway for a moment, looked at the deserted tarmac and the wide, slightly polarized terminal windows on the second level, where no happy friends and relatives stood waiting to embrace arriving passengers, where no impatient travelers waited for their flights to be called. Of course he knew. It was the Langoliers.
The Langoliers had come for all the foolish, lazy people, just as his father had always said they would. In that same gentle voice, Craig said,
In the bond department of the Desert Sun Banking Corporation, I am known as the Wheel Horse. Did you know that? He paused for a moment, apparently waiting for Brian to make some response. When Brian didn't, Craig continued. Of course you didn't. No more than you know how important this meeting at the Prudential Center in Boston is. No more than you care. But let me tell you something, Captain. The economic fate of nations may hinge upon the results of that meeting. That meeting from which I will be absent when the role is taken.
Mr. Toomey, that's all very interesting, but I really don't have time.
Time? Craig screamed at him suddenly. What in the hell do you know about time? Ask me, ask me. I know about time. I know all about time. Time is short, sir. Time is very fucking short.
Hell with it. I'm going to push the crazy son of a bitch, Brian thought. But before he could, Craig Toomey turned and leaped. He did a perfect seat drop, holding his briefcase to his chest as he did so. And Brian was crazily reminded of that old Hertz ad on TV, the one where O.J. Simpson went flying through the airports in a suit and a tie.
Time is short as hell, Craig shouted as he slid down,
briefcase over his chest like a shield, pants legs pulling up to reveal his knee-high dress for success black nylon socks. Brian muttered, Jesus, what a fucking weirdo. He paused at the head of the slide, looked around once more at the comforting known world of his aircraft, and jumped. 10 people stood in 2 small groups beneath the giant wing of the 767 with the red and blue eagle on the nose. In one group were Brian, Nick, the bald man, Bethany Sims, Albert Costner, Robert Jenkins, Dinah, Laurel, and Don Gaffney. Standing slightly apart from them and constituting his own group was Craig Toomey, a.k.a. the Wheel Horse. Craig bent and shook out the creases of his pants with fussy concentration, using his left hand to do it. The right was tightly locked around the handle of his briefcase. Then he simply stood and looked around with wide, disinterested eyes. What now, Captain? Nick asked briskly. You tell me. Us. Nick looked at him for a moment, one eyebrow slightly raised, as if to ask Brian if he really meant it. Brian inclined his head half an inch. It was enough. Well, inside the terminal will do for a start, I reckon, Nick said. What would be the quickest way to get there? Any idea? Brian nodded toward a line of baggage trains parked beneath the overhang of the main terminal. I'd guess the quickest way in without a jetway would be the luggage conveyor. All right, let's hike on over there, ladies and gentlemen, shall we? It was a short walk, but Laurel, who walked hand in hand with Dinah, thought it was the strangest one she had ever taken in her life. She could see them, as if from above, less than a dozen dots trundling slowly across a wide concrete plain. There was no breeze, no birds sang, no motors revved in the distance, and no human voice broke the unnatural quiet. Even their footfalls seemed wrong to her. She was wearing a pair of high heels, but instead of the brisk click she was used to, she seemed to hear only small, dull thuds. Seemed, she thought. That's the key word, because the situation is so strange, everything begins to seem strange. It's the concrete, that's all. High heels sound different on concrete. But she had walked on concrete in high heels before. She didn't remember ever hearing a sound precisely like this. It was pallid somehow, strengthless. They reached the park luggage trains. Nick wove between them, leading the line, and stopped at a dead conveyor belt which emerged from a hole lined with hanging strips of rubber. The conveyor made a wide circle on the apron where the handlers normally stood to unload the flatties, then re-entered the terminal through another hole hung with rubber strips. What are those pieces of rubber for? Bethany asked nervously. To keep out the draft in cold weather, I imagine, Nick said. Just let me poke my head through and have a look. No fear, won't be a moment. And before anyone could reply, he had boosted himself onto the conveyor belt and was walking bent over down to one of the holes cut in the building. When he got there, he dropped to his knees and poked his head through the rubber strips. We're going to hear a whistle and then a thud, Albert thought wildly, and when we pull him back, his head will be gone. There was no whistle, no thud. When Nick withdrew, his head was still firmly attached to his neck, and his face wore a thoughtful expression. Coast's clear, he said. And to Albert, his cheery tone now sounded manufactured. Come on through, friends. When a body meet a body and all that. Bethany held back.
Are there bodies? Mister, are there dead people in there?
Not that I saw, miss, Nick said, and now he had dropped any attempt at lightness. I was misquoting old Bobby Burns in an attempt to be funny. I'm afraid I achieved tastelessness instead of humor. The fact is, I didn't see anyone at all. But that's pretty much what we expected, isn't it?
It was, but it struck heavily at their hearts just the same. Nick's as well, from his tone. One after the other, they climbed onto the conveyor belt and crawled after him through the hanging rubber strips. Dinah paused just outside the entrance hole and turned her head back toward Laurel. Hazy light flashed across her dark glasses, turning them to momentary mirrors.
He's really wrong here, she repeated and pushed through to the other side.
One by one, they emerged into the main terminal of Bangor International Airport, exotic baggage crawling along a stalled conveyor belt. Albert helped Dinah off, and then they all stood there, looking around in silent wonder. The shocked amazement at waking to a plane which had been magically emptied of people had worn off. Now dislocation had taken the place of wonder. None of them had ever been in an airport terminal which was utterly empty. The rental car stalls were deserted. The arrivals, departures, monitors were dark and dead. No one stood at the bank of counters serving Delta, United, Northwest Airlink, or Mid-Coast Airways. The huge tank in the middle of the floor with the Buy Maine Lobsters banner stretched over it was full of water, but there were no lobsters in it. The overhead fluorescents were off, and the small amount of light entering through the doors on the far side of the large room petered out halfway across the floor, leaving the little group from Flight 29 huddled together in an unpleasant nest of shadows. Right then, Nick said, trying for briskness and managing only unease. Let's try the telephone, shall we? While he went to the bank of telephones, Albert wandered over to the budget rent-a-car desk. In the slots on the rear wall, he saw folders for Briggs, Handleford, Marchant, Fenwick, and Pesselman. There was no doubt a rental agreement inside each one, along with a map of the central main area, and on each map there would be an arrow with the legend, "You are here," on it, pointing at the city of Bangor.
But where are we really? Albert wondered. And where are Briggs, Handleford, Marchant, Fenwick, and Pesselman? Have they been transported to another dimension? Maybe it's the Grateful Dead. Maybe the Dead's playing somewhere downstate and everybody left for the show.
There was a dry, scratching noise just behind him. Albert nearly jumped out of his skin and whirled around fast, holding his violin case up like a cudgel. Bethany was standing there, just touching a match to the tip of her cigarette. She raised her eyebrows.
Scare you?
A little, Albert said, lowering the case and offering her a small, embarrassed smile.
Sorry.
She shook out the match, dropped it on the floor, and drew deeply on her cigarette.
There. At least that's better. I didn't dare to on the plane. I was afraid something might blow up.
Bob Jenkins strolled over. You know, I quit those about 10 years ago.
And now lectures, please, Bethany said. I've got a feeling that if we get out of this alive and sane, I'm in for about a month of lectures. Solid, wall to wall.
Jenkins raised his eyebrows, but didn't ask for an explanation.
Actually, he said, I was going to ask you if I could have one. This seems like an excellent time to renew acquaintance with old habits.
Bethany smiled and offered him a Marlboro. Jenkins took it, and she lit it for him. He inhaled, then coughed out a series of smoke signal puffs.
You have been away, she observed matter-of-factly.
Jenkins agreed.
But I'll get used to it again in a hurry. That's the real horror of the habit, I'm afraid. Did you, too, notice the clock?
No, Albert said. Jenkins pointed to the wall above the doors of the men's and women's bathrooms. The clock mounted there had stopped at 4:07.
It fits, he said. We knew we had been in the air for a while when, let's call it the event, for want of a better term, when the event took place. 4:07 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time is 1:07 a.m. PDT, so now we know the when.
Gee, that's great, Bethany said.
Yes, Jenkins said, either not noticing or preferring to ignore the light overlay of sarcasm in her voice.
But there's something wrong with it. I only wish the sun was out. Then I could be sure.
What do you mean? Albert asked.
The clocks, the electric ones anyway, are no good. There's no juice. But if the sun was out, we could get at least a rough idea of what time it is by the length and direction of our shadows. My watch says it's going on 9:15, but I don't trust it. It feels later to me than that. I have no proof for it, and I can't explain it, but it does.
Albert thought about it, looked around, looked back at Jenkins. You know, he said, it does. It feels like it's almost lunchtime. Isn't that nuts?
It's not nuts, Bethany said. It's just jet lag.
I disagree, Jenkins said. We traveled west to east, young lady. Any temporal dislocation west-east travelers feel goes the other way. They feel it's earlier than it should be. I want to ask you about something you said on the plane, Albert said. When the captain told us that there must be some other people here, you said false logic. In fact, you said it twice. But it seems straight enough to me. We were all asleep, and we're here. And if this thing happened at... Albert glanced toward the clock. At 4:07 Bangor time, almost everyone in town must have been asleep. Yes, Jenkins said blandly. So where are they?
Albert was nonplussed.
Well...
There was a bang as Nick forcibly hung up one of the pay telephones. It was the last in a long line of them. He had tried every one.
It's a washout, he said. They're all dead. The coin-fed ones as well as the direct dials. You can add the sound of no phones ringing to that of no dogs barking, Brian.
So what do we do now? Laurel asked. She heard the forlorn sound of her own voice, and it made her feel very small, very lost. Beside her, Dinah was turning in slow circles. She looked like a human radar dish.
Let's go upstairs, Baldy proposed. That's where the restaurant must be.
They all looked at him. Gaffney snorted.
You got a one-track mind, mister.
The bald man looked at him from beneath one raised eyebrow.
First, the name is Rudy Warwick, not mister, he replied. Second, people think better when their stomachs are full.
He shrugged.
It's just a law of nature.
I think Mr. Warwick is quite right, Jenkins said. We all could use something to eat, and if we go upstairs, we may find some other clues pointing toward what has happened. In fact, I rather think we will.
Nick shrugged. He looked suddenly tired and confused.
Why not? He said. I'm starting to feel like Mr. Robinson Bloody Crusoe.
They started toward the escalator, which was also dead, in a straggling little group. Albert, Bethany, and Bob Jenkins walked together toward the rear.
You know something, don't you? Albert asked abruptly. What is it?
I might know something, Jenkins corrected.
I might not. For the time being, I'm going to hold my peace, except for one suggestion.
What?
It's not for you, it's for the young lady. He turned to Bethany. Save your matches. That's my suggestion.
What?
Bethany frowned at him.
You heard me.
Yeah, I guess I did, but I don't get what you mean. There's probably a newsstand upstairs, Mr. Jenkins. They'll have lots of matches, cigarettes, and disposable lighters, too.
I agree, Jenkins said. I still advise you to save your matches.
He's playing Philo Christie, or whoever it was again, Albert thought. He was about to point this out and ask Jenkins to please remember that this wasn't one of his novels when Brian Engels stopped at the foot of the escalator, so suddenly that Laurel had to jerk sharply on Dinah's hand to keep the blind girl from running into him.
Watch where you're going, okay? Laurel asked. In case you didn't notice, the kid here can't see.
Brian ignored her. He was looking around at the little group of refugees. Where's Mr. Toomey?
Who?
The bald man Warwick asked.
The guy with the pressing appointment in Boston.
Who cares? Gaffney asked. Good riddance to bad rubbish.
But Brian was uneasy. He didn't like the idea that Toomey had slipped away and gone off on his own. He didn't know why, but he didn't like the idea at all. He glanced at Nick. Nick shrugged, then shook his head.
Didn't see him go, mate. I was fooling with the phone, sorry.
Toomey! Brian shouted. Craig Toomey! Where are you?
There was no response, only that queer, oppressive silence. And Laurel noticed something then, something that made her skin cold. Brian had cupped his hands and shouted up the escalator. In a high-ceiling place like this one, there should have been at least some echo, but there had been none. No echo at all. While the others were occupied downstairs, The two teenagers and the old geezer standing by one of the car rental desks. The others watching the British thug as he tried the phones. Craig Toomey had crept up the stalled escalator as quietly as a mouse. He knew exactly where he wanted to go. He knew exactly what to look for when he got there. He strode briskly across the large waiting room with his briefcase swinging beside his right knee, ignoring both the empty chairs and an empty bar called the Red Baron. At the far end of the room was a sign hanging over the mouth of a wide, dark corridor. It read, Gate 5, International Arrivals, Duty-Free Shops, U.S. Customs, Airport Security. He had almost reached the head of this corridor when he glanced out one of the wide windows at the tarmac again, and his pace faltered. He approached the glass slowly and looked out. There was nothing to see but the empty concrete and the moveless white sky, but his eyes began to widen nonetheless, and he felt fear begin to steal into his heart. They're coming, a dead voice suddenly told him. It was the voice of his father, and it spoke from a small, haunted mausoleum tucked away in a gloomy corner of Craig Toomey's heart. No, he whispered, and the words spun a little blossom of fog on the window in front of his lips. No one is coming. You've been bad. Worse, you've been lazy. No, yes. You had an appointment, and you skipped it. You ran away. You ran away to Bangor, Maine, of all silly places. It wasn't my fault, he muttered. He was gripping the handle of his briefcase with almost painful tightness now. I was taken against my will. I was shanghaied. No reply from that interior voice, only waves of disapproval. And once again, Craig intuited the pressure he was under, the terrible, never-ending pressure, the weight of the fathoms. The interior voice did not have to tell him there were no excuses. Craig knew that. He knew it of old. They were here, and they will be back. You know that, don't you? He knew. The Langoliers would be back. They would be back for him. He could sense them. He had never seen them, but he knew how horrible they would be. And was he alone in this knowledge? He thought not. He thought perhaps the little blind girl knew something about the Langoliers as well, but that didn't matter. The only thing which did was getting to Boston. Getting to Boston before the Langoliers could arrive in Bangor from their terrible, doomish lair to eat him alive and screaming. He had to get to that meeting at the Prue. He had to let them know what he had done, and then he would be free. He would be free. Craig pulled himself away from the window, away from the emptiness and the stillness, and plunged into the corridor beneath the sign. He passed the empty shops without a glance. Beyond them, he came to the door he was looking for. There was a small rectangular plaque mounted on it, just above the bullseye peephole. Airport Security, it said. He had to get in there. One way or another, he had to get in there. All of this craziness. It doesn't have to belong to me. I don't have to own it. Not anymore. Craig reached out and touched the doorknob of the airport security office. The blank look in his eyes had been replaced by an expression of clear determination. I've been under stress for a very long time, since I was 7. No, I think it started even before that. The fact is, I've been under stress for as long as I can remember. This latest piece of craziness is just a new variation. It's probably just what the man in the ratty sport coat said it was. A test. Agents of some secret government agency or sinister foreign power running a test. But I choose not to participate in any more tests. I don't care if it's my father in charge, or my mother, or the dean of the Graduate School of Management, or the Desert Sun Banking Corporation's board of directors. I choose not to participate. I choose to escape. I choose to get to Boston and finish what I set out to do when I presented the Argentinian bond buy in the first place. If I don't... But he knew what would happen if he didn't. He would go mad. Craig tried the doorknob. It did not move beneath his hand, but when he gave it a small, frustrated push, the door swung open. Either it had been left slightly unlatched, or it had unlocked when the power went off and the security systems went dead. Craig didn't care which. The important thing was that he wouldn't need to muss his clothes trying to crawl through an air conditioning duct or something. He still had every intention of showing up at his meeting before the end of the day, and he didn't want his clothes smeared with dirt and grease when he got there. One of the simple, unexceptioned truths of life was this. Guys with dirt on their suits have no credibility. He pushed the door open and went inside. Brian and Nick reached the top of the escalator first, and the others gathered around them. This was BIA's central waiting room, a large square box filled with contour plastic seats, some with coin-op TVs bolted to the arms, and dominated by a wall of polarized floor-to-ceiling windows. To their immediate left was the airport newsstand and the security checkpoint which served Gate 1. To the right, and all the way across the room, were the Red Baron Bar and the Cloud 9 restaurant. Beyond the restaurant was the corridor leading to the airport security office and the International Arrivals Annex. "Come on," Nick said, and Dinah said, "Wait." She spoke in a strong, urgent voice, and they all turned toward her curiously. Dinah dropped Laurel's hand and raised both of her own. She cupped the thumbs behind her ears and splayed her fingers out like fans. Then she simply stood there, still as a post, in this odd and rather weird-listening posture. "What?" Brian said. And Dinah said, "Shh," in an abrupt, inarguable sibilant. She turned slightly to the left, paused, then turned in the other direction until the white light coming through the windows fell directly on her, turning her already pale face into something which was ghost-like and eerie. She took off her dark glasses. The eyes beneath were wide, brown, and not quite blank. "There," she said in a low, dreaming voice. And Laurel felt terror begin to stroke at her heart with chilly fingers. Nor was she alone. Bethany was crowding close to her on one side, and Don Gaffney moved in against her other side.
"There. I can feel the light. They said that's how they know I can see again. I can always feel the light. It's like heat inside my head."
"Dinah, what?" Brian began. Nick elbowed him. The Englishman's face was long and drawn, his forehead ribbed with lines. "Be quiet, mate."
"The light is here."
She walked slowly away from them, her hands still fanned out by her ears, her elbows held out before her to encounter any object which might stand in her way. She advanced until she was less than 2 feet from the window. Then she slowly reached out until her fingers touched the glass. They looked like black starfish outlined against a white sky. She let out a small, unhappy murmur.
"The glass is wrong, too," she said in that dreaming voice.
"Dinah," Laurel began.
"Shh,"
she whispered without turning around. She stood at the window like a little girl waiting for her father to come home from work.
"I hear something."
These whispered words sent a wordless, thoughtless horror through Albert Costner's mind. He felt pressure on his shoulders and looked down to see he had crossed his arms across his chest and was clutching himself hard. Brian listened with all his concentration. He heard his own breathing and the breathing of others, but he heard nothing else. "It's her imagination," he thought. "That's all it is." But he wondered. "What?" Laurel asked urgently. "What do you hear, Dinah?"
"I don't know," she said without turning from the window. "It's very faint. I thought I heard it when we got off the airplane, and then I decided it was just my imagination. Now I can hear it better. I can hear it even through the glass. It sounds a little like Rice Krispies after you pour in the milk."
Brian turned to Nick and spoke in a low voice. "Do you hear anything?"
"Not a bloody thing," Nick said, matching Brian's tone. "But she's blind. She's used to making her ears do double duty." "I think it's hysteria," Brian said. He was whispering now, his lips almost touching Nick's ear. Dinah turned from the window.
"Do you hear anything?" she mimicked. "Not a bloody thing. But she's blind. She's used to making her ears do double duty."
She paused, then added,
"I think it's hysteria."
"Dinah, what are you talking about?" Laurel asked, perplexed and frightened. She had not heard Brian and Nick's muttered conversation, although she had been standing much closer to them than Dinah was.
"Ask them,"
Dinah said. Her voice was trembling.
"I'm not crazy. I'm blind, but I'm not crazy."
"All right," Brian said, shaken. "All right, Dinah." And to Laurel he said,
I was talking to Nick. She heard us. From over there by the window, she heard us.
You got great ears, hon, Bethany said.
I hear what I hear, Dinah said. And I hear something out there, in that direction.
She pointed due east through the glass. Her unseeing eyes swept them.
And it's bad. It's an awful sound, a scary sound,
Don Gaffney said hesitantly.
If you knew what it was, little miss, that would help, maybe.
I don't, Dinah said, but I know that it's closer than it was.
She put her dark glasses back on with a hand that was trembling.
We have to get out of here, and we have to get out soon, because something is coming, the bad something making the cereal noise.
Dinah, Brian said, the plane we came in is almost out of fuel.
Then you have to put some more in it, Dinah screamed shrilly at him. It's coming, don't you understand? It's coming, and if we haven't gone when it gets here, we're going to die. We're all going to die.
Her voice cracked and she began to sob. She was not a Sybil or a medium, but only a little girl forced to live her terror in a darkness which was almost complete. She staggered toward them, her self-possession utterly gone. Laurel grabbed her before she could stumble over one of the guide ropes which marked the way to the security checkpoint and hugged her tight. She tried to soothe the girl, but those last words echoed and rang in Laurel's confused, shocked mind.
If we haven't gone when he gets here, we're going to die. We're all going to die.